What's up, everybody? My name is Dimitri Kafinas, and you're listening to Hidden Forces, a podcast that inspires investors, entrepreneurs, and everyday citizens to challenge consensus narratives and to learn how to think critically about the systems of power shaping our world. Today's episode was recorded as a live Q&A on Thursday, March 23rd. It features two guests who have each been on the podcast before, Brent Johnson and Jeff Snyder. We discussed the Fed's latest rate hike decision, speculation about ongoing contagion in the banking system, and if the Fed is indeed as clueless as some of its critics contend, or if there is a method to the madness of raising interest rates at the same time as the financial system shows further signs of instability and weakness. You can find related podcasts to this one on this week's episode page at hiddenforces.io, where you can also access our premium content, including transcripts, intelligence reports, and key takeaway videos by joining one of our three content tiers. All subscribers gain access to our premium feed, which you can use to listen to on your mobile device using your favorite podcast app, just like you're listening to this episode right now. If you want to join in on the conversation and become a member of the Hidden Forces Genius community, which includes Q&A calls with guests, access to special research and analysis, in-person events, and dinners, you can also do that on our subscriber page. And if you still have questions, feel free to send an email to info@hiddenforces.io, and I or someone from our team will get right back to you. And with that, please enjoy this expansive and timely conversation with my guests, Jeff Snyder and Brent Johnson. All right, welcome everybody. I am Dimitri Kafinas. I'm the host of the Hidden Forces podcast. I'm joined today by two previous guests of the show, Jeff Snyder and Brent Johnson. Jeff is the chief strategist for Atlas Financial and co-host of the very popular Euro Dollar University podcast. And Brent is the CEO of Santiago Capital, where he manages money for high net worth families. Today's conversation is part of our ongoing investor roundtable series. These are live Q&As that I host for members of our Hidden Forces Genius community. We occasionally open these up to non-members as a way of showcasing our speakers' work, and also so that you guys have an opportunity, people outside the community have an opportunity to see what the community is like, what the experience is like, and to be able to ask questions. Because of how many people we have in this Zoom, we're going to keep questions to the Q&A box. And that's where I can filter them better. So make sure to keep your questions clear and concise so that I can get to as many of them as possible. So guys, welcome. Right at the top, I'm curious to ask you guys, what do you think the significance is of the last 2 weeks? Why don't we start with you, Jeff? How about that?
The significance of the past couple of weeks are a couple of things. Number one is basically confirmed that what markets have been pricing for quite some time, especially since late October into November, you saw curves really invert heavily, which was a sign that something was going on. And then, of course, you know, Silicon Valley Bank and Signature, all that stuff. And not really all that interested in the individual cases of those banks, Credit Suisse either, more the systemic implications. So in the grand scheme of things, it was, okay, we were worried about something. And then now I think this something that we saw over the last couple of weeks is kind of the tip of the iceberg. So the markets reacted to it as that's okay, this is the beginning of something even more, exactly what we were expecting, something breaking in the banking system, monetary system, a deflationary outbreak, and what do we have moving ahead that's behind all of that?
So, Brent, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I would tend to agree with that. I think the way I would highlight it is that despite the inflationary pressures we've had for the last year, 2 years, however you want to describe it, and despite the fact that there may be some inflationary pressures that continue, our system is inherently unstable. The design of the system makes it inherently unstable. And as a result, based on the design, it is always going to be prone to these shocks, especially when you have a group of individuals trying to manage the whole thing. And they will always try to fix it. And they may fix that one thing they're trying to fix, but they'll cause five other problems when they fix the one they're trying to solve. And eventually that will show up in the marketplace. And I think that's what we're seeing today. And for the last couple of weeks, some of these unintended consequences or some of the things that they weren't ready for or some of the destabilizing effects based on the design of the system. Again, we don't need to go into too much detail, but when people start taking their money out of the system, that causes the system to seize up. And that's basically what happened. People started to withdraw their money. That caused a bunch of unintended consequences. And, you know, here we are.
So, Jeff, let me ask you something, because you spend a lot of time looking at price signals to tell you what is going on in what are called Eurodollar markets, which is the demand for US dollars internationally. And so you've been seeing tightening credit conditions for a while now. And I'm curious what you've seen over the last few weeks to tell you what perhaps the reaction of markets has been to what has occurred, because we also heard Jerome Powell kind of allude to this in his press conference, which is that somehow or other, they've adjusted their response function to try and calibrate and take into account the tightening that's happening endogenously in markets and try to handicap their rate rises based on the expectation that there's already some additional tightening that's happened. And I'm curious, to what degree can we actually intuit that as market participants?
Well, I don't know if you can quantify it. I don't think it's quantifiable. You know, you can't look at a Eurodollar futures contract or even the curve and say, this is literally going to be this. But you can get a sense of probability, spectrums of probabilities of what the market is thinking. Their history with Eurodollar futures is beyond tortured because, I mean, you'll go back in the transcripts for 2008, the Eurodollar futures market told you the 2008 crisis was coming. And as it was coming and coming and coming, they kept saying, well, we're going to ignore Eurodollar futures because that's just hedging. Just to clarify, Eurodollar futures are really hedging instruments that large players in the marketplace use to hedge their massive portfolios. And really, the way you look at Eurodollar futures is, if everybody suddenly starts hedging quite a lot, buying Eurodollar futures, that's probably a pretty valid signal that what's ever going on, we don't really know exactly what it is, but what's ever going on in the marketplace, it's causing a lot of people to start hedging. So that's probably something you need to pay attention to. And that's where we were before we even got to this March. The markets were already massively inverted in a way that we hadn't seen since 2007, really the late part of 2007 into 2008. And since then, it's been absolutely insane. Ever since the Friday that SVB was finally announced, taken into receivership, all that stuff, we've seen swings and moves in the Eurodollar futures market that we have never seen before. The Monday afterward, which was what, the 13th, I think it was, Monday the 13th, we saw moves, I mean, stuff that I never thought we'd ever see. And again, it's hedging. So these massive money participants in the global system suddenly were in so much demand for hedging instruments that they were willing to pay through the roof for essentially insurance on these massive portfolios. And again, this was after SVB, this was after the Fed's BTFP, after the FDIC, and it continued all the way through last week and into this week. So we're still seeing heavy action in hedging, which tells you the market is still very much worried about something. That something cannot be what Jay Powell said, which is, oh, maybe it's a little bit of tightening after some depositors move some money out of a couple regional banks. It's a little bit more involved in that. It's a little bit wider scale, and it's a little bit more intense. So I think Powell, he understands the implications here, but he's never going to come out and say, yeah, this is probably not going to be good.
Brent, do you have any thoughts? And then I have a few thoughts and some questions to what Jeff
yeah.
said.
My take on it is very similar, but a little nuanced in that I don't think that Powell and the Fed is completely surprised by this. I mean, I think this is what he's been trying to do. He's been trying to slow the economy down by raising rates. Now, I know there's a lot of people out there who think that the Fed is just full of morons, and I'm just not willing to go there. I think they're. I know this is the part that Jeff and I slightly disagree on. I think they may be very misguided. I think they're extremely arrogant. And I think that they can manage the global economy. I think they're so arrogant that they actually think they can pull it off. And so I think, but by raising rates, they wanted to slow the economy, and they believe that they can then, when it comes time to save it, they can push a few more levers and save the system. Now, I don't believe that they can do that, but I think they believe they can do it. And so I think what we're seeing now is the kind of the real world manifestation of Powell thinking that he can stick the landing. And I think there's going to be fireworks, you know, as he tries to do it.
So this is a slightly complex question, but it hinges on ultimately what role the Fed is playing here. And I mean, there's like a running joke between Jeff and I always say that I don't want to trigger him when I ask this question. I'm generally not actually, this is not actually a joke, because I don't think necessarily, I don't understand you to necessarily be saying, Jeff, that the Fed has no role to play, but simply that it isn't the role that they think it is, or it's not that important. And my question is, in the context of where we are right now, do you have a view on what the Fed should be doing? And to the extent that they have any competency at all. I mean, I don't know if you quite literally mean like they're completely 100% incompetent or mostly incompetent. And to the extent that they're not completely incompetent, what do you think that they understand about the economy?
Yeah, I mean, well, there's a lot there. And I think, you know, going back to what Brent said and getting to what you said, I mean, I agree with Brent to that extent that they do believe that they have a primary role to play. But I think they're also aware it doesn't always seem to work out the way they want it to. And the reason is because they've been left off into another smaller corner of the actual monetary system when being thrown off to the side over many, many decades has forced them to develop a different way of looking at what they do as well as how the system works. And because of that, what they think they have to do is essentially try to get the marketplace to do the job that the Fed used to do or any central bank used to do for it, which means they have to send a bunch of complex smoke signals up using all these different tools and techniques that everybody thinks is actually money printing or it's some form of actual liquidity, when all it's really trying to do is get the banking system, the monetary system, to do their job for them. And so they believe they have all these sophisticated models that say, if we do this, then we can get the banks to do this, and then the economy will end up just fine. That's the operating theory, but obviously it's more complicated. And history has shown in practice, it doesn't work all that well. So the Fed continually tries to influence bank behavior when time and again, when you see commercial banks aren't willing to respond to these signals in the way the Fed wants them to, that's the end of the story. And so what the markets have been telling us over the last year is Jay Powell wants to be Paul Volcker. That's what he wants to do. He wants to be remembered as the guy who broke the back of inflation, you know, through whatever means necessary, whatever way he could possibly do it. And the markets were saying, well, we don't believe this is a long-term problem. You were right the first time when you said this was transitory. So there's been a disagreement in the marketplace all along about whether we even needed rate hikes to begin with. If the Fed had done nothing over the last year, markets were pretty sure it was going to end up the same way regardless. It wasn't about the rate hikes or the Fed. It was about the situation from 2020 and 2021, all that massive government interference that created massive distortions. And when you have harmful distortions, eventually they have to be paid. The bill eventually comes due. And that's the point that the markets have been focused on all along, not really about what the Fed is going to try to pretend to do about it.
So I have a follow-up question to that. Because I agree, with the smoke signals are forward guidance. And there's an interesting conversation I have about whether or not forward guidance works worse than it used to. I feel like it's become much less effective, if not completely ineffective today. And I think there are like all sorts of interesting reasons as to why. I think it's a combination of institutional credibility or lack thereof, and also the fractured media ecosystem that is making centralized communication and messaging much more difficult in general for governments and institutional actors. But one of the things that I think the Fed still has the ability to do is selectively bail out parts of the economy. And I wonder if kind of what we're beginning to see now, Jeff and Brent, this is a question for both of you, is that as the system becomes more indebted and as the governments on the last cycle in 2008 stemmed a crisis of illiquidity and solvency by taking on the liabilities of the private sector, trillions of dollars of private sector liabilities, putting them on the sovereign balance sheet, that we're moving towards a place where the crises are going to develop increasingly on sovereign balance sheets. And that means that governments are going to have to exercise discretion over who gets the capital and who doesn't. What Russell Napier has kind of broadly called credit rationing that falls within the bucket of financial repression. I wonder, you know, what do you guys think of that thesis, that this is kind of the framework of where we're going?
Again, there's a little bit of a duality here. And I think this is where Jeff and I agree, but maybe we see it a little differently in that there's several things that are going to happen regardless of what anybody does. Like, to me, the dice has been thrown You know, they're bouncing along and we've just got to wait for them to play out. And I'll give an example. Like, I think the small and regional banks are going to continue to fail. And I, you know, if you look over the last 20 years, we used to have 14,000 banks and now we have 4,000. I think 10 years from now, there'll be 500 or whatever it is. You know, I think that trend is going to continue. And I don't necessarily think the Fed is purposefully trying to cause it, but I don't think they mind if it happens. So there's part of, are they managing it or are they allowing it to happen? Or are they just watching it happen and not trying to stop it? And I don't know the answer for sure, but I think the point I would want to get across is the Fed and the monetary authorities, they are important players. They can affect outcomes, but they are not the biggest player. And the biggest player is the market itself. And the biggest player in the market is the euro dollar market. And that, this is my opinion. I think the euro dollar market drives everything. It got away from them back in the 50s and 60s and kind of started to develop on its own. And I know a lot of people think that the only reason the world uses dollars is because the U.S. forces them to use dollars. Now, there's a component of that, but there's also a private market component of that where the euro dollar market developed on its own out the side of government regulation, and it became a self-reinforcing force, for lack of a better way of saying it. And now there's this big monster out there that the Fed thinks that they can control, but they can't. To me, it doesn't really matter what Z and Putin want to do. You know, if they want to try to start settling trade in yuan or rubles, that's great. They can try to force that on their end as well. But the market's going to demand payment in euro dollars. And I just think that's out of the control of most of these monetary mandarins or government authorities, however you want to describe them.
I think that's great, actually. And that leads me to want to ask a question later about CBDCs. And because I think the reason that a lot of people think that the CBDC thing has become a meme, that the U.S. is going to basically launch a central bank digital currency, is really because people's frameworks around how the dollar system works, what the network effects of the dollar system are that create dollar hegemony, and also the difficulty of actually like doing that and what it takes and, you know, how long something like that takes. But Jeff, like Brent sent you up here, but this is your baby. You know, we all follow you.
Yeah. I mean, he's the expert. Yeah. I've learned a lot from Jeff, so I'll hand off to Jeff here.
Yeah. And Jeff, you had, I mentioned this on our last conversation this week that came out on Monday, and I referenced our first conversation where you had said something to the effect of the dollar is a denomination, is a denomination, and no one owns that denomination. And I thought that that was really brilliant because I felt like it captured for me in a way that helped me understand even better the decentralized nature in which dollar liabilities are generated. So could you speak to that a little bit and feel free to just kind of pop off with whatever Brent said?
Well, I think Brent had it exactly right. There's a reason we use the US dollar denomination, and it's essentially that it's a common language. It's like if we have a broad decentralized computer network that's using all different language, it's not going to be efficient. But if we can standardize the approach where everybody uses the same language, it works really well. That's really all the euro dollar is. And that's why it looks a lot like the telecommunications network rather than a currency system, because it's basically about processing payment messages back and forth, settling payment terms, sorting them out, processing them as fast as possible. And that's the reason why we use it. It has nothing to do with the US military or the State Department or we hate the Fed or anything else. It's the fact that this decentralized bank-centered system has been so good at meeting the needs of its customers all over the world that it's essentially become indispensable. Even though over the last 15 years, it has malfunctioned repeatedly, it is still indispensable because there is nothing on the horizon that is even close to being able to replicate all of its functions in a way that is so dependable and reliable that even if we don't have the supply of euro dollars that we need, it can at least still keep everything running the way it's supposed to. And Brenda's exactly right. Xi Jinping, Putin, all those, they're going to try to minimize their exposure to the US dollar, but they're never going to be able to get away from it. But getting back to something you said earlier, Dimitri, about governments getting into the credit allocation process, that's really a function of this malfunction in the global monetary system. Because as it breaks down, what that means is there's not enough credit and money supply for all the things that we need. And so governments have tried to step into that vacuum. They're looking at all the problems, not really diagnosing what's wrong with them, and saying, well, we need to fix this. And as they offer these different solutions that never work, as Brent pointed out, they have to go a step further and further and further because they never work. And so it's almost like the Japanese example where every time it fails, the private system fails, the government steps in, that doesn't work. We got more private failure. The government steps in again, and we're in this reinforcing cycle, this repeating cycle, this vicious cycle where government does more and more and more. And it doesn't necessarily have to be as some part of a plan as we were talking about before, but it's just organically, the monetary system, the credit system isn't functioning the way we need it to. And so politicians are doing what politicians always do, which is more than they should.
You know,
Dimitri, let me say something really quick before I forget, because I think this is a very key point for people to understand. And I'll tell you, it took me forever to figure this out. And I still don't have it figured out perfectly. But it's the decentralized nature of the euro dollar system. You know, a lot of the big talk over the last, you know, 5-10 years with the growth of Bitcoin and other digital currencies is the decentralized nature of it. The dollar system is very decentralized. The Fed tries to centralize it. They try to pretend they're in control of it. And if it ever really started to break up, I would argue that the US government would try to enforce it. But right now, they don't have to enforce it because the market enforces it for them. And, you know, nobody made a South African manufacturer trade with an Indian textile dealer in dollars. They just did it because it was the most efficient, it was the cheapest, and it worked, right? Nobody made Japan import soybeans from Brazil in dollars, but they did it because it was easy and it was efficient. And there are innumerable little transactions and tangents of the system, spiderweb of the system, that no government forced anybody else to do it on. It's just the way the market chose to do it. Now, they chose a government centrally issued currency to replicate, but no government made them do this. Then they did it outside the bounds of not regulations, but they weren't regulated. It wasn't, nobody said this is how it has to be done. It was the market at work. And that's why it's so strong. And that's why it's so hard to break.
Yeah. Besides following Jeff and Brent on this, guys, I did an episode with Lev Menand, who wrote a book on this subject. And he gets into the history of the Eurodollar system. And so did Perry Merling in a kind of indirect way in his book, Money and Empire, which is a history of the international dollar told through the life and times of Charles Kindleberger. Both have been on the show before. I want to echo what you said, Brent, because there's a reason why no one forced USDC or Tether to peg to the dollar. No one forced international crypto markets to exchange in dollars, to use dollars as a medium of exchange. That's what network effects are. So, I mean, I think that's like hugely important for people to kind of realize it. And it was one of a series of aha moments for me. I also want to just kind of say one more thing, and then let's see if maybe we'll do a question on CBDC, and then I want to start getting into some of these questions that people have, because we got a ton of these, and I'm going to do my best to filter through, because we can't get to all of them, obviously. I feel like the process that we've been going through is a move from this more open, outsourced, you know, lending and banking model, where not only the creation of money happens through the banking system, but also the due diligence and everything. And the sense of how much money the economy needs is outsourced. It's outsourced to banks who make those determinations based on the credit needs and the due diligence and everything else, to a system that's more closed and controlled. And besides that obviously not working as well and having all sorts of implications for freedom and privacy, it's also a really difficult system to recreate. And that's my biggest worry about all this stuff, right? It's like, how do we get back to where we were? Well, we don't. And I don't really know where that goes. But let's talk about CBDC.
That's so important.
Yeah, and feel free to respond to that if you like. But I just wanted to mention CBDCs because I feel like this happens all the time. This happens with the dollar, the end of the dollar memes, and a lot of other stuff. And CBDC is the same thing. It's more like there's a feeling. It kind of clicks somehow. It becomes a meme and it spreads. And I think CBDC is a perfect example because I haven't seen anyone like seriously working on this in government. I'm not familiar with anybody seriously working on it. I've just seen a bunch of white papers and stuff. The Biden administration put out some kind of a, you know, policy statement about it. It's an extremely difficult thing to do, number one. And number two, it would actually undermine dollar hegemony. So there's all these cross currents. And I feel like one of the reasons why people struggle with this stuff is a lot of people seem to have this kind of Austrian gold standard model of banking in their heads, where banks are reserve constrained. and there's fractional reserve lending and all this other stuff. So anyway, I what do you guys think about CBDC, and why do you think that this has become such a kind of hot topic, and now people seem to think that the U.S. is about to launch one?
Look, Mitri, you're exactly right. Your gut feeling is no government is actually seriously working on a CBDC. The Chinese are.
Yeah.
They're further along than others, but it's not a legitimate currency. It's not a crypto product. It's not a digital asset. They are not investing nearly enough time, effort, and talent on developing something that would actually work. And the only reason they're getting into the digital space is because the private sector has been eating their lunch time and time again. Every time they try to kill crypto, Bitcoin, whatever, anything else, it comes back stronger than ever. And there's a reason for that. And they realize that they're losing the arms race to the private money market, these private money projects. And therefore, they have to, like you said before, to try to reinforce this dollar hegemony, at least in the denomination, say, well, we're working on one too. So you don't have to worry about all that digital stuff because we're doing one ourselves. It's basically the same sort of psychological, emotional manipulation that everything else the Fed does. But trust me, they are not working on central bank digital currencies that are an actual working currency, not even close.
Well, not only that, but if and when they do come, they're not going to be decentralized. They're going to be totally centralized. I mean, that's the whole point of a government project, is to centralize something. You know, and along, you know, let me say something else, because I want to make sure I say it before I forget. Going back to what, because we've talked about Xi and Putin a little bit, I kind of feel like many people, and let's just say the West, right? We hear our leader, we hear Biden say something, or we hear, you know, the UK president say something, we laugh and, oh, let them try and make us do that. We wouldn't do that. You know, that's not going to work. But then we hear Xi and Putin say, we're going to make all of our trade, including the trade with Africa and South Africa and the rest of Asia, done in yuan. And they read that and they think all the people are just going to say, okay. Hmm. Well, those people laugh at their politicians the same as you laugh at your politicians. And the market is not just going to take what the government says and automatically do it. Now, in some places, the government is more able to force them to do their bidding than others. And some, you know, economies are more strict, some are more loose. But the idea that Xi and Putin can just say, we are going to now conduct a third of the world's trade in yuan, and everybody's going to say, okay, and there's not going to be chaos, is completely ridiculous. It doesn't work that way.
You know what it is, Brett? It's the dollar is dead meme personified.
Yeah.
It's okay. You know, anything that looks like it's dollar positive, we'll ignore. That's stupid. That's crazy. Okay. But if it's, oh my God, the dollar's being replaced, then we're going to take that 100% seriously. And you know this as well as I do, Brent. We've been hearing this for over a decade. I mean, the PBOC governor, Zhao Xuanshan, I forget how to say his name, but way back in 2009 said, we're working on a dollar replacement. You can guarantee it. That was 14 years ago. So that's what it really comes down to. If you already believe the dollar is dead, then you take Russia and China at their word when there's absolutely no evidence you should.
I will say, I do think that a central bank digital currency is where it's headed. Now, I don't think it's going to be tomorrow, and it's probably not going to be next year. At some point, I do think, you know, the governments have seen the power of these private currencies. The genie's out of the bottle. Government doesn't like competition. So they're going to try to co-opt this new technology that developed to their own uses. And at some point, they'll probably roll it out. And hopefully, it'll be a little bit more successful than when Obamacare rolled out their website or anything else. But, you know, the idea that it's just tomorrow or next week, they're going to roll out this central bank digital currency from Shanghai or Beijing, and all of a sudden it's going to spread throughout the world and going to take over everything. It doesn't work that way. And that's kind of why that's why I pound the table on this so hard. Not necessarily because I want the dollar to be the dollar. It just is. Like it's recognizing the fact that it is.
Look, that's an important point. You know, we're not here sitting here cheerleading as dollar chauvinists or American chauvinists here. It's the same with the treasury market. We're not treasury bulls. We're trying to be realistic about what the situation is. And I agree with you, Brent. I think that the governments do realize to a certain degree that the digital genie is out of the bottle and they're trying desperately to catch up. But I also think they might know and might realize that if they do go in the direction of a central bank digital currency, that is going to drive more people toward private digital projects than it will be to attract people. So I think that's one of the reasons that they're trying to slow motion this, is because there's got to be some worry in their minds. Like, if we do this, what if this thing backfires? What if it drives everybody to a private currency instead of the other way around? So
related, this gets a little bit conspiratorial, but again, this is kind of one of those happy accidents or coincidences that they don't mind. You know, when you have Silicon Valley Bank go down and you have Silvergate go down and you have Signature Bank all of a sudden go down, even though they didn't really have to go down, and those are three big digital asset related banks, I don't think it's a total coincidence, right? Maybe that wasn't the actual plan, but I don't think they minded that that happened, if that's the right way to say it.
No, you're exactly. I mean, what better way to try and discredit digital currencies than to say, look, digital currencies are so dangerous. Look what they did to these perfectly fine, upstanding institutions. Just being in bed with digital currencies caused them to fail overnight. Don't even think about all that crypto stuff because it is bad, bad, bad. And, you know, one of these days, maybe 20 years from now, we'll roll out our own digital currency and that'll be perfectly safe. So just be happy with the status quo. I think that's absolutely the case, Brent.
You know, what I think is also interesting is that I remember having so many conversations with maximalists, basically Bitcoin maximalists, in the years leading up to this.
Is there any other kind?
No, it's Bitcoin. I call them Bitcoin jihadists or Bitcoin fundamentalists. And their view for years was the governments can't stop it. But now so many of them are really upset at what the governments are doing. And I say this, why? Because you guys both talk about this, Brent especially. Governments are very powerful. And I feel like what we're seeing now and what we saw in the 2008 financial crisis is that when the governments want to, whether for whatever reason, maybe they feel threatened, and usually that's what it is, they just change the rules and reset the game. And I feel like, you know, that is kind of where we're going on another cycle. And I think the real question for me, and now we're going to get some questions, is what happens this time around, you know, post-2008, we got incremental change. And we kind of muddled along for another decade. And I feel like what we're going through now is kind of unresolved issues from the 2008 crisis. You know, we spent the last, you know, 12 years or whatever in a kind of suspended animation. And the real, one of the big questions for me is, does that happen again? Or do we get some kind of bigger reset out of this? And what does that look like, both domestically within the US and other Western countries, and internationally, what does it mean for the role of the dollar? And I think these are interesting and legitimate conversations to have. And I think what I try to have on this show is to have them with people that are thoughtful about that and kind of think, you know, coherently about it. So I'm going to kind of start going through a few questions here, guys. And I'm going to do my best to get through, try to identify the ones that are maybe the easiest for you to answer. So one question has to do with the Fed pivot. And that's simply, so I'm going to elaborate on it. The question is actually, do you think that the unwind after the pivot of rates will be as fast as the increases that we've seen? I'm going to add to that, not only, you know, how quickly do you guys feel like the Fed would pivot? What would that pivot look like? But really, how effective would something that like that really be at this stage? So that's the question.
Well, you look at the Eurodollar futures market or the Treasury curve, whatever it happens to be, the market is absolutely convinced that once the rate cuts start, they're going to come fast and furious. When you look at it today, the April contract is upside down a little bit to the June contract, which is the market saying there's a somewhat realistic chance that the Fed pivots at its next meeting. And then from there, it just goes, zoom. So you've got, you know, 75, 80 basis points to December, another 115 to the following December. Again, we don't take the contracts literally. It's not the market saying that we expect 325 basis point rate cuts in the second half of the year. What the market is saying, you know, wide band, but balance of probabilities, that the probability we get zero rate cuts in the second half of the year is probably zero. And the probability that we get a lot of rate cuts in the second half of the year is realistically high. And then it's going to continue forward. That's why the curve is so inverted into 2024, through the end of 2024. So the markets are telling us, again, we're hedging as if whatever's happening today is going to pay off when rates go a lot lower than where they are right now and a lot sooner than was maybe that certainly the Fed was expecting. Does that work? It didn't work in 2008, did it? In fact, that's why the Fed had to keep coming up with all these four-letter tools, was because they realized way too late in the process that just cutting the federal funds rate target had no effect whatsoever, because why the hell would it?
How much of this is about inflation? Obviously, some of it is. To the extent that they can do anything about it, that's a different question, the Fed. But it's in their mandate. But I wonder how much of it's also like wanted to get the stock market down. The more they can get the stock market down without causing broader financial instability seems like something that they would want, not just because of the wealth effect, but there are other, I think, at least political motivations to doing that. Not too far down, because now the stock market's a political utility. It's where people have their retirement funds, because that's what we've done. But anyway, I just threw that in there. But go ahead, Brent.
Well, there's a lot in there. I mean, we could probably spend an hour talking about one little piece of that. But with regards to the pivot, I think it's important to understand when they have to pivot, they will. So anybody who thinks that they won't is crazy. The whole reason that central banks exist in the first place is to be the lender of last resort. Now, whether you think they should or shouldn't, it doesn't really matter. When the system comes into question, they will try to save it. And if they don't try to save it, the Congress will yank the chairman out and put a new person in who will try to save it. They're not independent. I don't care what anybody tells you, central banks are not independent. The second thing is that because of politics, I think the rate hikes and what's been going on is because of inflation. Now, whether inflation is real, whether it's not real, whether you think it's going to continue, whether you think it's going to fall, again, it doesn't matter, because the public, the people out there, and the politicians are getting calls from their, constituents saying, the inflation is too high. And Biden's approval ratings are down because inflation is too high. And, Powell's is his chairman. And so, they, from a political perspective, they want to get inflation down, because the populace is not happy with the way it is. And so that has impacts. So then that's why Powell raises rates. And he thinks he can stick the landing. He is arrogant enough to believe that he can do it. The other part of it is, and I don't think this can be discounted. I've had this conversation several times about half the people agree with me and a lot of people don't. But I don't think you can discount Powell's personal legacy with this. Like, he does not want to end up as Arthur Burns. He wants to end up as Volcker, and he doesn't care if the stock market is lower to get it. He thinks that by getting the stock market lower, he can reduce demand, and by reduced demand, you can reduce prices, and by reducing prices, you can reduce inflation, right? That's his thinking. And if he, after screwing up the whole transitory thing so badly, if he, now screws up this thing, if he pivots, and for whatever reason, and I know all of Jeff's very good arguments for why it wouldn't matter, if inflation printed higher after he pivoted, he's dead. Like, politically, he's dead. From a reputational perspective, he's dead. And I don't think he would allow that. So I think that's why he has hiked as much as he had. And that's why I think he will resist pivoting for as long as he can. But when the system demands it, he will pivot. And then he'll be the hero, or at least he can say, I pivoted because I had to, but my main goal was inflation. I just think there's less personal legacy risk for him to fight the pivot than there is to just give into it, even though pivoting might be the right thing to do.
Well, don't forget too. I mean, Brent, at that point, the politics are going to reverse.
No, exactly. Right. No,
because
exactly.
Everybody's calling their congressman, and congressman's calling Jay Powell and saying, We hate inflation. Do something about it. And the Jay Powell's like, what do you want me to do? I can't get oil out of the ground. Yeah. But so he started hiking anyway, because that's what was really matters.
That's the theater. That's the theater, right?
And once this banking thing starts to really hit the real economy in a way that we think and the markets are expecting it to, the phone calls are going to stop talking about inflation, and they're going to start talking about, will you do something to save the banks? So that's what's going to happen. And that's where Powell, forget his legacy. At that point, it's political expedience. And that's what drove them in 2022 to aggressive rate hikes, even though they knew they couldn't really do much about consumer prices at that point. And that's what's going to drive them into rate cuts. And the market is saying that what's going on isn't really about Silicon Valley Bank. It's a systemic issue. And once it becomes absolutely clear that it's having negative effects on the real economy, whether it's financial volatility, stock market going down too much, whatever the case may be, that Powell will not be able to resist. Whether he still wants to hike rates or not, that choice has been made for him.
Yeah. Man, I'm going to take questions, because I keep wanting not to. I keep wanting to ask other questions of my own. So one of our listeners said, after listening to the second half of the podcast from Monday, I became a member of Eurodollar University. I own a trucking logistics company and feel like the canary in the coal mine. I feel the ups and downs and the pain in the first economic cycle changes. I felt the turn in the middle of March 2022. So, broader question, Jeff, how does like his experience of what's happening with the economic cycle and what Phil seems to be describing as a kind of turn downwards compared to what you're seeing in the data?
There was so much consistency, real economy, anecdotes, data with what markets were doing at the time it happened. You go back to December 2021, that's when Eurodollar futures first inverted way down the curve. It was just a little, tiny little bit, which was the market saying, as consumer prices go up, as we get another leg up in oil, this is not going to end well. And of course, in March was when you had that sharp spike in oil, Russia invaded Ukraine, all that stuff. And that's when you started seeing inversions get a little more heavy. You got inversion in the treasury curve right at March, which was the marketplace, the monetary system reacting in real time to what was happening on the ground. So it's perfectly consistent with what this question is saying, is that in March, the market started to really shift to more pessimism. It was like, okay, we expected something like this to happen. Obviously not Russia invading Ukraine, but some shock would come along that would be too much for the economy to handle, given its already weakened state. The economy was never booming in 2021. That's why the curves were behaving the way they were. What they were saying is there would be a shock that would happen. We don't know what it is. And that would push everything over the edge. So as that happened, you could see in real time, market curves take in all that information that we can't otherwise see and put it out there in the inversions and the changing shapes of the curve. And ever since last March, it's been one big thing after another. We saw another shift in June, and then again in November and December leading up to this year. So I think there is a consistent picture of markets and economy from both the ground up level as well as top down.
Another question has to do with what the questioner asks as a bigger geopolitical game. The question is there a bigger geopolitical game going on here, one in which the U.S. would engineer a global recession and stronger U.S. dollar in order to hurt adversaries? I've said, guys, in multiple episodes, including the one with Nick Timiraos, where I asked him this, and he kind of poo-pooed it. I don't know that he poo-pooed it because he necessarily disagreed or because he had to, because he's Nick Timiraos. But I did feel like during the early days of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the conditions of the international political system and the move, this kind of move towards multipolarity that we've been experiencing, made the Fed less reticent to collaborate and cooperate, and maybe sort of saw a side benefit of a stronger dollar in this kind of broader fight against Russia and China. What do you guys think? Do you see that any of that at all at previously? And what about now? I mean, separating the time frame.
I personally believe that that's part of it. And I kind of feel like the dollar might have done what it would have done, what it did anyway, but them hiking rates aggressively sure as hell didn't hurt, right? So the fact that the euro dollar market chose the euro US dollar as their currency, you know, du jour, whatever, 30, 40, 50 years ago, whenever it really kind of took off. Again, the US didn't make them do it, but I'm sure they're happy that they did, and they can now use it to a certain extent to their advantage. And I think that they know how to use it. Now, I don't think they have perfect control of it. I know Jeff's going to sit there and say, they don't know what they're doing. They can't do anything. I think that they don't have perfect control of it, but I think that they very well know that it can be used as a weapon. And I think it absolutely is used as a weapon.
Well, 100% it's used as a weapon. Yeah. In fact, one of the main debates in policy circles now is, are we overusing the weapon? And the more we use it, the duller it gets. I mean, that's a big concern that people seem to have. Jeff, what do you think? One, answer that, you know, question about, are we verging on cuckoo conspiratorial here? And then also, what do you think about people that say that the more the U.S. uses sanctions, the less effective they will become, and the more countries will be incentivized to move away from the dollar system?
Well, I think, you know, those are two separate issues in my view, that sanctions and the politics of it are separate tools and not necessarily weaponizing the dollar, quote unquote, because I don't think the dollar can be weaponized. And I think we've seen a number of recent examples where the Eurodollar system proved its, I don't want to say its worth, but its usefulness in how it was really developed. I mean, one of the origin stories behind the Eurodollar was Soviet banks back in the 1950s who didn't want to hold their dollar balances in American banks, because they were afraid, you know, Eisenhower, then Kennedy, would confiscate their dollars. So exactly what we saw happen over the last couple of years started this revolution, or one of the reasons this revolution got as big as it did, was because they had the ability to use the layer on top of this old correspondence system to decentralize basically global payments using, again, the denomination, not actual the physical currency. And that is still happening right now. So they have this decentralized network. They call it the US dollar. That doesn't really matter as much. So I think, just to answer your question briefly, that, yeah, sanctions are a different story than maybe trying to get the dollar to go up in value to dissuade people from using an alternative. I don't think that's what drives alternatives anyways. Brent, you know, I love the way you put it before, Brent, you know, the South African manufacturer didn't choose the US dollar because it's going to go up in value. That the up going up in value is actually the opposite of what we want to happen. We want a stable currency, not one that moves in either direction a lot, either way.
Oh, I was just going to say, though, secondary sanctions work in a distributed way. So, yes. I mean, and we did see sanctions really have an awful impact on the Iranian economy.
Well, I guess, you know what, let me address that really quickly, because I hear this all the time, the sanctions don't work. For the most part, I tend to agree, sanctions don't work. And there's, you know, for as long as there've been rules, there's been black markets to circumvent them, right? And there's always a way. You know, the rule says you can't do it, there's always a way to do it, to get around the rule. But to argue that sanctions don't have any effect or don't work at all, I think all you have to do is look at the GDP growth of Venezuela, Iran, and Russia for the last 10 years. You know, those economies that have been sanctioned
Cuba
have not performed greatly.
Cuba?
Right. No, that's what I'm saying. So, you know, the idea that all of a sudden you get sanctioned and your economy is going to blossom and do fantastic, that's not going to happen. Now, places like Russia that have, you know, critical commodities that the rest of the world needs, it's harder for sanctions to hurt someplace like that. But, you know, Venezuela has a lot of energy as well. And, you know, they went from having one of the highest standards of living in the Western Hemisphere to one of the lowest in about 5 years. So the idea that sanctions don't have any effect and they don't do anything, I would be very careful about going down that path.
But also Cuba is a great example because sanctions had very little impact on Cuba so long as the Soviet Union was around and was able to subsidize Castro's regime. After the fall of the Soviet Union, when you lived in this really unipolar world where the U.S. ran the show, those sanctions were, and export controls and embargoes, those things were really powerful. There's a really interesting question here by someone, and I'm going to ask it. It's not necessarily related to what everything we've been talking about just now, but I think it's interesting. And I'm going to read it and I want you guys to reflect on it. So he says, what makes a bank safe? Is it the riskiness of the asset side or more the liability side? Does having a large deposit base versus wholesale funding base make a bank safer? Australian banks have 66% deposits to 33% wholesale funding. Are they safer than Eurodollar banks like Credit Suisse and Deutsche Bank? Really interesting meta question that most of us don't really ask ourselves.
It's a really good question. And there's no single answer, but I guess if you could design a bank that would do very well, you'd have to have good management who is smart and knew how to manage risk, first of all, have a good risk management team. And then secondly, have a deposit base that's very sticky, right?
The opposite
because
of
what's
Silicon
led
Valley
to all
Bank.
These problems is the deposits being pulled out. You know, if your deposit base isn't sticky, you have troubles. I mean, if you're a bank and your deposit base isn't sticky, you're in trouble. I mean, banks are inherently unstable if the deposits don't stick around. I mean, that's just the nature of fractional reserve banking. So I don't have the perfect answer for the questioner, but it's a very good answer. But that is what made Silicon Valley Bank particularly vulnerable, was they had, number one, no risk management, and number two, a very flighty deposit base.
But it wasn't flighty up until the last minute. And you can argue that they didn't know it was flighty until it actually happened.
Okay, fair enough.
I think the question is actually thinking more systemically in the right way. Is it more assets or is it more liabilities? What is it that makes bank a trouble bank? And I think it's more liability than it is assets, because at the end of the day, as we saw in 2008, despite most popular perceptions, those mortgage bonds that plummeted in value, they were all money good. The mortgage bonds the Fed bought, they made money on those. What happens is banks don't have the liquidity or the liquidity management to be able to get through a systemic event. And so what happens is they don't manage their liability structure correctly, and that leads them to fire sale assets at the absolute worst time, which is exactly what happened to Silicon Valley Bank. It wasn't that they had all of these paper losses and treasuries in their book, it's that they actually sold them because they didn't have any other way of raising liabilities to manage, to keep their assets and liabilities managed. So there is a lot more risk on the liability side than there is on the asset side, making sure that you protect yourself, that you have backstops and other forms of liquidity that you can get into in case you do run into, whether it's deposit flight or wholesale flight. Because think back to 2008. That was not a depositor crisis. That was a wholesale crisis. And so banks, especially the bigger banks that were super reliant on wholesale funding, wholesale liabilities, they're the ones that got into trouble. And it may be the exact opposite this time around, because the bigger banks have access to deposit funding. They're fine. They don't have any wholesale problems. And I always ask the question, or at least I have over the last couple of weeks, why didn't Silicon Valley Bank go into repo? You know, so, but the question is thinking about this in the right way, that the systemic problems are usually on the liability side. And we only notice the assets when banks are forced to sell them when they don't want to, or really when they shouldn't.
It's interesting because I use a regional bank, and I've felt, and I've said this before, I've felt safer in money market funds than any money I have at a regional bank that's over the FDIC deposit limit because of the precedents that have been set. I just want to comment on the listeners' questions in terms of what it made me think about. And that is that, first of all, we're not safe. Nobody's safe. Nobody in this life is safe in any existential sense of the word. And I feel like a lot of what life is, you know, kind of managing the anxieties and risks that come with that. And whether it is the 2008 financial crisis, whether it was 9/11, and the story that governments told us after 9/11 to make us feel safe, I feel like what we've seen in our societies has been that governments come in and they say, don't worry, you know, whether it's we're going to go out into the dark places and kill people in tunnels so that they don't come here and hurt you, or don't worry, we're going to save all your deposits and everything. At the end of the day, that all comes back home to roost. And I think it creates the illusion of safety, but it makes us more insecure. Let's see. There was a question I saw here and I lost sight of it. Actually, let's ask a question about this. So there's a question here about Credit Suisse, because I don't think we had a chance to talk about Credit Suisse, did we?
Not yet.
What did you guys think about how that bailout was engineered and what happened to the bondholders? And does that fit into this paradigm of, again, we spent the last how many decades taking national governments and building supranational structures of multilateral cooperation? And one of the areas where that was really successful was central banks, you know, through the BIS and IMF. And, you know, so we had all these multilateral institutions. And now are we seeing something where governments are increasingly saying, whoa, national interest here. We don't care if they're Saudi bondholders. You know, we don't care what the rules are. We're going to do what we need to do to take care of our particular constituents or our banks or whatever. Like, does this fit into a new paradigm of operating governments taking more and more control over the economy?
Again, they will try. Now, will they have any effect, or will they be as successful as they think they are? You know, I think Jeff would argue, no, they won't be. But that doesn't mean they won't try. And I think Credit Suisse was particularly interesting for a few reasons. One is Credit Suisse is so iconic for Switzerland itself, right? It would be very hard for Switzerland to let another firm other than UBS take them over. It would kind of be a black mark on Switzerland itself. Not only that, if you think about all the history of Swiss banking, right? The idea that all of a sudden now a French bank or a US bank is going to control the private bank and all the secrets that go along with a European private bank, you know, or a Swiss private bank, that just was, to me, it was never going to happen. The biggest surprise for me for Credit Suisse was honestly like that it didn't happen earlier. Like they've been a dead man walking for a couple of years, if not 10 years, but it finally came to be. And I think this populism stuff does, you know, it is part of it, you know, and the fact that the Swiss government, you know, kind of forced the sale on a Sunday and, you know, changed the law in order to get it done. You know, there was an element of populism in that. You know, they wanted it to go to UBS. They didn't want it to go bankrupt. They didn't want it to go to an outsider, you know. There was the biggest investor was from the Middle East. And so, you know, there's all this stuff that goes into it. But the idea that banks and governments are somehow immune from populism, banks more than anything, but banks are one of the most, they're not immune from populism. They're one of the most affected by populism, I would argue. You know, you go back through history, there's been a number of problems that have come up with banks, and populist answers or responses were taken.
Yeah, you know what, Brent? What really struck me about Credit Suisse was, why now? Because I agree with you. I mean, how long have we been talking about Credit Suisse being a troubled bank? It seems like I can't remember a time when it wasn't a troubled bank, right? It goes back forever. So what happened over the last 10, 12 days that made the Swiss authorities say, today's the day we have to step in? That's what I get back to. This is more than just Credit Suisse or Silicon Valley Bank. There was something very Bear Stearnish about the way this was put together, sort of the last minute, that had me thinking, all right, did they run out of collateral? Was there some form of liability run beyond depositors, beyond, you know, not being able to fund everything? Something happened that triggered a government response, because I think you guys are both right. There is a larger issue, especially with Credit Suisse, about we don't want to take it over. We really, really, really don't want to do that. But then all of a sudden on Sunday night, they said, we got to do this. And I think that's what's really spooking the marketplace, is that this isn't really about that single bank, is that the system itself is reevaluating everything in it and saying, you're Credit Suisse, you're a troubled bank, goodbye. I'm done with you. You're Silicon Valley Bank, you screwed up your bank, you're experiencing a deposit run. You know what? We're going to cut you off too. So the system is slow. You know, it's the old analogy about the tide rolling out. The tide is rolling out and we're starting to see who's been naked the whole time. Well, nobody's surprised that Credit Suisse was naked. That's not a surprise. Silicon Valley Bank, maybe that was somewhat of a surprise. But I think the overall point here is that the tide had receded so much. And let's not forget, it was in the middle of March, which is when the tide is at its low point anyway. So that's,
well, I think the other thing that's interesting for me, of course, you know, I've obviously get a lot of questions regarding the dollar and all that goes along with
kind of,
that.
But, you've kind of made yourself the target for that.
But what's really happened lately is, like, you know, the U.S. raised rates and they blew themselves up in the process. Well, yes, I'm not saying that they didn't, but let's not forget that, you know, the whole Cantillon effect, right? Like, whoever's closest to the money benefits the most and they get hit the last. Well, the idea that the U.S. got hit first here is completely incorrect. I mean, for God's sakes, the Bank of England had to save the gilt market 8 months ago. The Bank of Japan had to come in and save both the yen market and the JGB market in the same week back in September, right? The ECB 9 months ago, when they first started raising rates, in the meeting where they first raised rates, they also set up a facility to buy periphery bonds to keep their yields down. So this isn't something that just popped up out of nowhere and hit the U.S. first. This has been coming for a while, and the signs were all there. Now, why did it happen in the last 2 weeks, and why did it, you know? And again, this isn't like at a bank level. This is a country level, right? Like Europe, I mean, England itself was in trouble. The ECB was in trouble. The Bank of Japan, Japan itself was in trouble. China cut reserve ratio requirements, I don't know how many times last year, and had to get involved in the banking system to keep that going. Credit Suisse has to save one of their marquee, or Switzerland has to save Credit Suisse. These are country issues. It isn't just like a small little industry on the periphery of the global economy. These are the countries, and they're not small countries. These are major countries. And so it is a systemic issue. And nothing underlies an economy more than the banks and the money. And it is a monetary banking systemic issue.
Yeah, that's a really good point too, Brent, is that people will always say, well, this just came out of the blue. This was totally unexpected, when it was anything but. We've seen it coming the whole way. And, you know, I think the problem is nobody knows that they should connect what happened last September in the UK gilt market with this overall. I mean, what does that have to do with Silicon Valley Bank? What does Silicon Valley Bank have to do with Credit Suisse? What does any of that have to do with the fact that Pakistan was out of reserves in early February? Because you're right, it's not, we're at big level stuff that's been going on, but for most people, they can't say, well, there's the monetary system behind all of these things that connects all these dots. So that when we're saying the tide was coming out, that's what we mean. The tide was going out last year and revealing the gilt market was in trouble for a variety of reasons. Pakistan, Sri Lanka, all these major countries that are having monetary issues, that stemmed for a lot of these systemic issues that go back into the 2020 and 2021. So that's what we mean. The tide has been coming out for quite some time. And that's what the markets have been saying. That's what's been driving inversions, that there was going to be a time when the tide went out too far and it created something like we're seeing now, which looks a lot like a systemic crisis, not just a isolated instance of a couple bank failures, but a lot bigger than just that.
What's also interesting, let me say this before I forget, and I know there's probably a lot of people saying, well, how did the market stay up and how did equities rally so hard from September into March? And, you know, I know it was a year ago when the curve first inverted, but then if I remember right, it kind of leveled back off. And then the real inversion came in June, July timeframe. You know better than I do, Jeff. And so people would think, okay, that's an automatic sign of a recession. It always leads to a recession, you know. But the reality is every time we've had a curve inversion, it usually takes 9 to 12, 18 months before that curve inversion leads to a recession. And usually what happens in that 9 to 12 months is that equity prices go higher. And I don't know why that is. I just know that it is. I don't have the answer. I don't know why it should happen. I just know that it usually does. And so it's pretty interesting that the curve inverted last summer. And here we are 9 months later. And all of a sudden we have this, the market's kind of shaky again. And we've got these crises showing up.
Well, I mean, the same thing happened in 2007. We had the crisis begin on August 9th, all this stuff. We had funds blowing up, banks getting into trouble, Northern Rock. The Fed comes in and cuts the federal funds target by 50 basis points, and that it sparked a rally. Shares actually got to a record high in October 2007. This was after the whole thing began, because until it becomes obvious that this kind of thing is happening, most people are predisposed to buy shares and take risk. And so up until just the last week and a half, most people thought, well, what does this UK stuff have to do with me? What's there are some Swiss dollar auctions and credits. What does that have to do with US equities? So as long as it stays buried under the surface and Jay Powell says, don't worry about it. And everybody on TV says, this is no big deal. As long as it stays hidden, everybody wants to be risk on, especially in financial services, where that's where they make their money. That's where they get paid. It's only when it really starts to become absolutely perfectly, unmistakably clear that things are going wrong, that's the point when everybody starts to get nervous and sell.
Yeah.
Guys, why do people have this framework in their heads that when the Fed pivots, and whatever that is, whatever we decide what that is, that markets are going to moon? Why do people have that framework in their heads when that's not actually typically how it works?
Because it sounds good, right? I mean, Brent, you know.
Well, is it because of the last few years with the pandemic? And I mean,
If you think that the Fed being friendly is the reason the stocks went so far up in 2021, and if you think that QE is the reason why stock share prices bottomed in 2009 and went forward, if you think Jay Powell is your friend, or when he's your friend, that's the time to buy stocks, it sounds terrific. The Fed pivot, that sounds awesome. That means no more rate hikes. We're going to get rate cuts. Shares should go to the moon, when you really need to stop and think about, why would the guy who wants to continue hiking rates to become Paul Volcker suddenly stop involuntarily and start cutting rates? That's not a friendly environment at all. But I don't think a lot of people think two, three steps ahead.
Well, yeah. And if you go back to 2000, I mean, I started in this business in 99, and I mean, I really didn't know anything at all when I first started. But what I do remember is, you know, after the dot-com peak and started coming down and they started cutting rates and being, markets didn't go higher. They went down for about 2 or 3 years. And I remember, because I was just starting off in the business and it was brutal. Like every day you'd come in and the stock market was down again, like literally every day for like 2.5 years. And they were cutting rates and they were instituting programs. And, you know, and even in the 2008 and 9, you know, from when they first started to do injections in QE, the market didn't take off right away. So if and when the Fed pivots, that's not a good sign, right? They're pivoting because, and I was trying to make this point over the weekend, the whole point of them pivoting is there's a hole in the economy and they're trying to fill the hole. And if you hear the word QE, okay, they're throwing liquidity into the hole. That's great. But you don't know how big the hole is. So number one, they haven't done QE yet. They've done some injections, some loans. It's not QE. And number two, they're trying to fill a hole that they don't even know how big it is. So if you've only got like not even half the battle won. If you see them do something and all of a sudden you think it's QE, you got to be careful.
Yeah, I mean, that's where you look at the discount window, the primary credit, or the FHLB advances. If you see a huge spike in discount window, that's not a positive sign. That means that there are a lot of people out there who are not getting wholesale funding that they need. And there's probably a lot more who can't even show up at the discount window or get any funding. So, Brent, that's the most important takeaway. I know you know this. It's the most important takeaway is that we don't know how big the hole is, and we'll never be able to know. That's why you have to look at market prices, because that's the only information we have. Quantitatively speaking, if the Fed is doing a lot, it's because that hole is a lot bigger than what the Fed is doing.
It's very counterintuitive. It's very counterintuitive, but because we've been trained to, and Jeff, you probably more than anybody have said, they're just monkeys, right? They're just, it's all theater. It's the guy behind the curtain. And they've done a good job of training the public that when, you know, when they hear Janet Yellen say something, or when they say Jay Powell say something, they're like, ooh, go buy. And that's what they want you to do, right?
So we've gotten a bunch of questions about swap lines, you know, kind of end game, where this goes, cooperation, new multilateral institutions, and one question on emerging markets and what effect this has had on emerging market economies. I'm going to kind of merge some of those questions in together. So what are we seeing in terms of demand for dollar funding and for access to dollar swap lines from central banks? Like, what's going on there? And is there an opportunity for the U.S. to exercise dollar diplomacy here and kind of not be a total idiot?
Is that really an option?
You want to take that one, Jeff, or do you want me to?
I was laying that out for Jeff, if you guys could.
Yeah. Well, as far as dollar swaps go, I mean, the way you're thinking, Dimitri, is exactly right. There is an arrogance here, because even with these dollar swaps, which in my opinion, they don't ever work, just like the discount window or everything else, it's a sign that something's wrong when they're being used. But even now, who are the dollar swap lines with? It's the major central banks. It's the Bank of Canada, the Bank of England, the ECB, the SNB, and the Bank of Japan. What about the PBOC? What about Banco do Brasil? What about any of the emerging markets that are really starved for dollars? Why are we only doing these dollar swaps with specific large developed country central banks? So you're right to your skepticism here. I share that because there is an arrogance here that I don't think serves the interest of what we want them to do, which is what they're really supposed to be doing is recognizing that there is a global dollar system and that there is a problem in the global dollar system, and they need to do something about that. And if they were serious about that, they would have more standing swap line agreements with these emerging market central banks than they would with, say, Switzerland or Europe, because as you put it, Brent, it's just monkeys in theater. That's what it really comes down to.
And this is where I believe, and of course I can be wrong, this is where I think that there is some strategy to it. And I think that they will give a swap line to our allies and to the people that we're friendly with, but the economies that we're not friendly with, or who are not scratching our back or are not helping us out with whatever it is we want to be helped out with, then we withhold. You know, it's like if you got a bunch of kids, right? And a couple of your kids are being good and getting good grades, you give them an allowance. And the ones that are taking a red marker and writing all over the walls, you withhold the allowance until they get in line. And I think that is part of what is going on with swap lines. And I think my thesis is that in 2020, we had, whether it was real or just perceived, a global systemic event, and the whole world had to work together to overcome it. So swap lines were given to everybody. Everybody kind of cooperated. Everybody did similar policies and, you know, pushed through it. But I think this is much different now. The world is more fractured than it was 3 years ago. And in many ways, it's fractured because of 3 years ago. And so I don't think there's going to be the cooperation and the coordination going forward that there has been for the last 30 years. And in fact, I think not only will there not be cooperation, but I think there will be active, what's the opposite of cooperation? You know, active things put in place to keep. Yeah. You know, and I think it will be done purposely. Now, should it? Maybe not. But I think it will be anyway. Doesn't matter whether it should be or not.
It's so short-sighted, right? Because you're basically arrogantly believing that if I don't help out Brazil, that's a problem for Brazil, when it's actually a problem for Brazil and you.
It's a problem for everybody. Yes. It's absolutely a problem for everybody. And to those who who have pushed back on, you know, the dollar going higher or the euro dollar thesis or however you want to describe that, the milkshake theory, however you want to describe it, they will say this ultimately comes back on the U.S. And yes, it absolutely will come back on the U.S. It sure as hell doesn't help Thailand in the meantime. It doesn't help Bolivia. It doesn't do any favors to South Africa or Turkey. And so, you know, the idea that the U.S. is going to have a banking system crisis and the rest of the world is magically going to be okay, it's about as close to insanity as anything I can think of.
And it's the opposite true, too, that the idea that the rest of the world will have a crisis and the U.S. will be immune from it. That was, right. I mean,
no, absolutely.
There is no hiding from this. There's really just varying degrees of damage.
That's exactly right.
So to echo something that you said, Jeff, I think you said something like, if anything, the countries that they should be giving it to more than anywhere is emerging market countries, and especially ones that are going to become important actors in the international system. And actually, that was literally the opening line of Paul Tucker's book, where Paul Tucker was the former deputy governor of the Bank of England. And he said that when he was at the BOE during the 2008 financial crisis, someone from the bank rushed in and said to him, someone from the Fed just refused India a swap line. And his answer was something to the effect of, those idiots, don't they know that India is going to be a great power? And his point was how, you know, for years, central banking had become divorced from the world of geopolitics, with the implication being that central bankers are going to need to, and governments are going to need to, think bigger picture about—
I actually think that they will. And I think this is how the U.S. will either maintain or get new allies. I think they will use this dollar swap line as a method via which to do that.
We also have to keep, I mean, guys, we have to keep in mind that the people who run these central banks and who staff these central banks are economists. They're not politicians. And as economists, they believe that economies are islands. They're mostly Keynesians. Yeah. So they believe the U.S. economy is the U.S. economy. If India runs into a dollar problem, that's not my problem. If you read through the transcripts, which I have, I've read through pretty much all of them. What you find is that time and time again, especially in 2007 and early 2008, they kept saying, this is not our problem. You have a dollar problem? That's not me. Is this a London dollar problem or is this a dollar problem? And they kept saying, well, that's a London problem. The Bank of England should take care of it. So there is an institutional reluctance to engage in international affairs because it's beyond their worldview as well as their mandate. Their mandate is inside the U.S. borders. They've only recently discovered that because this is a global dollar system, they probably should take a much wider, broader view of things. And so the dollar swaps are sort of a compromise between what they think they can do, what they should do, and reality. And I think that's the biggest impediment. I mean, one of the biggest things that really got me really pissed off, to be honest with you, was you read the transcript for September 2008, I think it was the emergency phone call about Lehman Brothers, and they were talking about the Chinese central bank lowering rates by an odd number. And here they were ridiculing these Chinese, how these idiot Chinese policymakers were reducing their benchmark interest rates by 26.92 basis points. And what was so ridiculous about that is, first of all, they didn't think that had anything to do with what they were doing. The entire U.S. system was falling apart and they're ridiculing other central banks who are having to respond to their not being successful at their own job. So it's a global system, but we have policymakers who think and act very provincially.
So guys, we've already run over. I want to ask you, if you want to hang around just a few more minutes, I want to ask you one specific question about crypto. It's a very broad one. And then a question about where we're going. And I'll try to ask that in a way that doesn't send us kind of everywhere. My question about crypto is, you know, like the crypto community has really been taking it on the chin in the last several years. You know, the U.S. government is really bringing down a bunch of enforcement actions. There is a kind of under siege atmosphere. And yet Bitcoin is going up. Ethereum has been rallying as well. I wonder, like, what is the role that you guys see for these currencies in a world where it's unclear to what degree they rival the dollar or could rival the dollar, let's say, or maybe a better way to put it is rival U.S. Treasuries as a, quote, store of value. At least that's Bitcoin's sort of raison d'etre. Like, I'm just curious, like, how you guys see all of this. Where does this go?
Well, I firmly believe that given enough time, we will be on a private digital money standard at some point. Now, that's not going to be tomorrow because there is no technology available that can replicate what their Eurodollar system does. But, you know, that's what these currencies are driving for. They are filling a vacuum. They're filling a need that is out there, whether we acknowledge it or not. And so eventually the private market will come up with a viable solution. And when they do, I happen to believe that the adoption model will be sort of like the Eurodollar adoption model, where it just takes incremental steps all the time in the background that before anybody really knows it, we've flipped over to a different system anyway. Because like the Eurodollar system, private digital currencies will be able to respond to the needs of the commercial system. Again, Brent, I love the way you put it. The manufacturer in South Africa doesn't really care what currency standard they're on. They just want to be able to make and sell their products. And so if you demonstrate a currency system that is able to fill their needs efficiently and effectively and predictably and reliably, they won't care. They'll start moving to a currency system that works. You just have to prove that it does. And so I think given enough time, there are so many smart people, there is so much smart effort going on, so much resources being dedicated to this because enough people realize that there is a future for private digital currencies. And I think, again, as we said before, that's why central banks are trying to catch up because they realize they're so far behind. And just to be clear, full disclosure, I'm actually working with a digital currency, a stablecoin project too. So I actually believe in this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I want to echo what you said, Jeff. And
that's
also,
that's the name of the coin.
Echo what you said, Jeff, is the name of the coin?
No, the Echo. It's ECO.
Oh, the Echo. Because the Eurodollar system was allowed. There, I remember reading like a series of exchanges between, I think it was McChesney Martin and members of Congress that were really upset when they found out what was going on with banks outside the U.S. creating dollars. I can't remember really the exchange that I had read, but I mean, they didn't actively try and kind of put the kibosh on the growth of the Eurodollar market. They allowed it to grow.
Yeah, Paul Samuelson, a famous economist, coined the term benign neglect.
Yeah, I was just going to say benign neglect.
You know what? We don't like this. This isn't perfect, but guess what? This is solving a problem that we needed to solve. And if we just look the other way and let it happen, perfectly fine. We won't talk about it. It's almost like don't ask, don't tell, right? We won't talk about this thing as long as it performs the job we want it to. We'll just let it happen.
Yeah. And so the question is, they don't seem to be taking the same approach with crypto. And to what extent is that going to be stifling for innovation in the space?
Well, so what I would say is not only did the benign neglect allow it to develop, it also allowed the politicians to get away with murder for longer because they're printing for the whole world, not just printing for America. The demand for the dollar is global. It's not domestic. This is why the U.S. is not going to go through hyperinflation before any of the other currencies. It doesn't work that way. But to what Jeff was saying, the market will eventually win. Market forces are stronger than government forces. And now I know that there's people out there listening to this right now, and they're thinking in the back of their head, Bitcoin or some other stable coin or some other digital ledger that's being used. And in the next 2 years, this is going to happen. I mean, I agree that it's going to happen, but it may be 25 years. It might be 30 years. It might be 50 years.
It's a long-term process.
It will win. The markets will win. And this is part of the reason why I've pushed back so hard on the anti-dollar crowd is a lot of the arguments are correct. The timing is just completely wrong. And I feel like people get a good idea. They understand the dynamics. They know where it's going to eventually end up. And then for whatever reason, they dramatically compress that time in their head and they allocate their portfolio that way. And that's how disasters happen.
The story I was thinking of was Wright Patman, who was head of the House Banking and Currency Committee at the time, raking McChesney Martin over the coals for having the Fed support dealer repo. And that was the early days of the Eurodollar market. That was the story I was thinking of. So last question, guys. At what point do you guys foresee that we will be out of this? And you can use a range of years, whatever. And then what does that look like being out of this? I'm just, you know, because being out of the 2008 financial crisis for me, in the context of what I'm describing here, was really kind of like 2012, when we kind of pivoted to a new regime. What is the equivalent today?
I mean, I personally think it's going to be 5 or 10 years. And I think ultimately things will get better, but I think before then it's going to get very dark.
What does that mean, though? Sketch that out for me.
I mean, I've said this before, and it sounds a little funny, but I actually believe it. Like, to me, this is the Game of Thrones. Like, all the big players are in there. Everybody's fighting their first survival. You know, the U.S. wants to stay on top. Some of the other guys are tired of being pushed down. And, you know, all the tools will be used to win the game. And, you know, that's economic, it's social, it's military. And I think we've got some tough years ahead of us. And I'm not saying this is not what I want to happen. I'm not advocating for this. I just want to be clear about this. I'm not advocating for this, but I think that's what's going to happen. And hopefully on the other side of that, you know, we can get some daylight.
What about you, Jeff?
Yeah, we have no idea where the other side actually is now. Right now, we're in the early stages. That's what everything is telling us. This is not end. Yeah. It didn't end with Silicon Valley Bank. It didn't end with Credit Suisse. That was sort of the starter pistol going off, announcing that this thing has just started. And I agree with Brent, this is not a sprint. This is a marathon. So the starter pistol went off for another marathon, because as you're saying, Dimitri, we went through this long scale crisis before and its after effects, and they aren't good. They're prolonged. So I tell you, know, my interest is more about what are the economic consequences, because can we really afford another non-recovery after a sharp recession? That really gets us into some really, really less than ideal political and social circumstances, which we've already experienced way too much to begin with. And that's, again, it's not just about the US or Europe or developed countries. It's all around the world, because there is no getting away from it. So I worry that in the short run, we're going to take too much economic damage that contributes even more to longer run cases that are already looking in the wrong way, already moving in the wrong direction to begin with. And I think I agree with you, Brent, here, at least I think we agree on this, that there's no solution in sight. So even when we get past the immediate crisis, whenever that happens to be, where does that leave us? That leaves us in the same freaking boat that we just left. It's not like we're going to go through a crisis and we come out of it, you know, like we all imagine a recession. A recession, the economy contracts, and then it recovers. And when the recovery happens, we go back to just the way things were before it happened. You know, this isn't 1990 anymore. So we go through these massive contractions, we go through these monetary events, and we come out the other side in far worse shape than we went into it with. And we've already done that. It's been 15 years already. You know, history shows that these things don't end well. I mean, there was a reason why World War II followed the 1930s. So the best case scenario is that the economics over the next several years don't get to be so bad we end up with the 1940s all over again. Hopefully that's not in our picture, but man, how much stuff is moving in that direction? It's something you can't deny. And as fantastic as that would have sounded to our, you know, 2007 selves, nowadays it's far too realistic. So the downside.
Well, and the reason it's realistic is everything is bubbled up to the country level. Like, you have countries in trouble now, right? It's not just companies, it's not just the banks, it's like the countries. And so that's where we're at.
We also, go ahead, Dimitri.
No, I was going to say, you know, in the 1930s and 40s, we had FDR and his fireside chats. We had a very different media ecosystem. And he also, FDR had established a certain level of credibility with Americans. And there was a sense of competency in Washington that doesn't exist today. And I think that's a big problem. So we haven't even gotten past that yet. And I think in some ways you could argue that the technological landscape today, the changes in the technological landscape today are, if not greater, certainly I would say are less well understood by the public. And they're happening so quickly that there is this kind of collective sense of having lost our minds. And it's difficult to operate on a civilization level when you have that kind of situation going. I wanted, before we end this, guys, I wanted to give you guys both a chance to tell people a little bit. I mean, people can follow Jeff on Twitter at Jeff_AIP, and they can follow Brent at Santiago AU Fund. So I just wanted to put that out there. But if people want to follow you guys beyond Twitter, understand your methodology better, and obviously, with you, Jeff, they can go to Eurodollar University. What's the web address? What are the things that people can do to, you know, like, actually, if they want to subscribe to your content, like, what are the options?
Oh, if you want to subscribe to the content, go to the website. It's easy enough. It's eurodollar.university. If you don't want to subscribe, you just want to listen to me talk, I have a almost daily, most daily YouTube show called Eurodollar University. I write a regular column that's freely available at Real Clear Markets. So if you search for Eurodollar University, you're probably going to find me somewhere.
Great. And what about you, Brent?
As you know, I'm very active on Twitter. I do a number of different podcasts. I recently just started my own podcast a month or so ago. I don't call it a podcast. I call it a show with my friend John. It's called Milkshakes, Markets, and Madness at Milkshakes Pod on Twitter. I try to interact with as many people as I can. I try the best I can to explain things in a way that kind of the layman can understand them, because this is a very complex subject. If anybody's having trouble with it, I would encourage you to keep with it, because you will eventually break through the fog and understand it. But I know that it is very hard. I know it's very confusing. And that's why I like doing, you know, the Hidden Forces, and I like talking to Jeff, and I like doing these different podcasts, because I think this is really important. I think we're at a critical time. I think it's more important that people kind of have a good foundation and a good framework for thinking about things than probably ever before. So I appreciate you hosting this, Dimitri.
No, it's my pleasure. I love doing this, guys. The thing that's tough for me is, like, you know, not asking questions and getting to listeners' questions. Guys, this, for everyone that's still on here that's not a member of the Genius community, the Genius members know this. We post these videos to the community where we have vibrant discussions and commentary. And we also host dinners on a pretty regular basis. Our next dinner is in London. It's already booked up, but it includes a number of the guests that we talked about today. I won't necessarily mention them by name, but I love discussions, and I love having, you know, access to people like you and sitting down and talking to you guys. It helps me think through things, and it's one of the things that makes this really valuable for me. So I wish you guys a good night. It looks like it's already gotten dark over there. It's getting dark over here.
Yeah.
So have a good night, guys, and I'll see you all on Twitter.
Yeah. Thanks, Dimitri.
All right. Take it easy.
See you, Brent.
Bye.
Bye. Bye, Jeff.
If you want to listen in on the rest of today's conversation, head over to hiddenforces.io/subscribe and join our premium feed. If you want to join in on the conversation and become a member of the Hidden Forces Genius community, you can also do that through our subscriber page. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. You can follow me on Twitter at Kofinas, and you can email me at info@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.